Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Heather Reads, the podcast. Today, we are still hanging around Regency London for a swashbuckling and romantic adventure. Last time, we took our first foray into historical fiction, and on the same day I picked up A Wolf in Duke's Clothing, I also came home with today's title, An Unexpected Earl by Anna Harrington. It was published on February 23rd, 2021 by Sourcebooks Casablanca, and it's the second book in the Lords of the Armory series. The author seems interesting. Anna Harrington apparently enjoys flying airplanes and ballroom dancing, and by her own admission via the About the Author blurb in the back of the book, uses her oven for shoe storage. We're in for an interesting one, aren't we? We'll take a look at the cover first, and I'm going to be blunt here. It's not nearly as good as the cover for The Wolfy Duke. The background is very blue. Blue night sky, blue river, blue bridge, blue street, which is probably set up for the contrast that is our heroine in a very red dress with black trim. And our hero is, well, okay. This kid got lost at a Renaissance festival. He is in all black and looks exactly like 90% of the 20-something LARPing wannabes who use the festivals as an excuse to get blackout drunk and stare at cleavage. Trust me, I have seen enough of them to know. And our lady's dress is barely passable. I just can't get it out of my head that she looks like a model on a sewing pattern from Joanne Fabrics. I want to say that looking like said models is not a bad thing, but coupled off with the knockoff Dread Pirate Roberts, it's not a good look. So with some trepidation, let's look inside that cover, shall we? It's August 1816, London, and Brandon Pierce, Earl of Sandhurst, is staking out a party. He's on a mission from the Armory, a group of former soldiers who have decided to take up investigative crime-solving as a way to ease themselves back into civilian life. He's been looking into ways to ferret out information about a crime syndicate called Spectre. Think of it as a Regency-era Hydra. And tonight, his leads have led him to a party. Unfortunately, the party doesn't seem to be of any use to him. So he does what any man would do and make the best of the situation. And by that, I mean ogle at the woman draped in a scarlet red dress. Before I go further, I had to look up some information about this book. Unlike the book She Dreamed of a Cowboy, the setting requires, well, setup. Readers may find themselves a little lost if they pick up this book without having read the first one. But this isn't a detriment, not really. It's romance dusted with adventure, so there's a fine line to balance between keeping new readers in the loop without boring long-time readers with information that they already have. It's a benefit of following new characters in every novel. Instead of sticking with current ones, we can see it with a new perspective. But all Pierce is seeing is a rather enticing woman in a dress to tempt the devil himself. The longer he stared at her, the more convinced that he was needed to introduce himself and do the gentlemanly thing of offering to help her out of her dress at the end of the evening with his teeth. Even from across the room, he could see that she wasn't like the other women in attendance tonight. Those women treated sex like a commodity, to be bought or sold to fit their needs. They were courtesans, auditioning new protectors for the long term, less skilled light skirts chasing the monthly rent in exchange for a few hours of bed sport, and society wives and widows escaping their normally boring lives with an evening's adventure, all safely hidden behind the anonymity of masks. But the lady in red didn't seem to be here for any of that. Even when talking to the men, she kept herself apart in a way that the other women didn't. She didn't lean in when they spoke to her, she leaned away. She didn't tap them flirtatiously with the fan, she held it between them like a shield. and she didn't view the other women as competition, giving no territorial signs toward any of them. No, she was distant, cool, wary. She did not belong here, despite the dress. Pierce, you are currently acting as a secret agent to uncover a secret evil society, and the moment you figure that your night is bust, you are tempted by a woman that stands out completely to you in a red dress. Woman has trap written literally all over her, and you're over here thirsting. Thank the plot lords that she is not a trap, but she does get herself into a spot of trouble with another partygoer. A different Earl was getting handsy with her, you know, at the party where men were encouraged to get handsy with the women, and she smacks him with her fan. The man does take offense to this, of course, and Pierce gives in to the White Knight syndrome and intervenes. The ego-bruised Earl is scuttled away, and Pierce does the thing where he demands a dance for saving her. She relents, shame, and as they dance, Pierce gets the feeling that he knows her from somewhere. He's been calling her Lady Scarlet, but she's hesitant to give her real name. Seriously, Pierce, these are all the warning bells. He does give her his name, and her reaction seals it for him that yes, he does know her from somewhere. She tells him that she's looking for another guest, Charles Varnham, and doesn't say why, obviously. It pushes into a sort of Cinderella moment where he keeps pressing her on her name and she keeps resisting until a man named Frederick Howard shows up and talks to Pierce. Scarlet takes her chance and books it away from the party, but sadly does not leave a shoe behind. Frederick had wanted to speak with Pierce about a property business venture, but Pierce escapes him to chase after Scarlet. As she steps into a waiting carriage, her hair and mask comes loose, and he gets the shock of the night. Scarlet is none other than his old childhood sweetheart, Amelia Howard. Amelia's own night has not gone to plan. She had been hoping to see Varnham, instead she gets sidetracked by Pierce, as well as nearly getting spotted by her brother Frederick. He was being blackmailed, and despite keeping it from Amelia, she found out anyway. So she's taken it upon herself to get to the bottom of the situation. And before you think that she's doing it out of sisterly devotion to help her brother, think again. She runs a charity shop that educates and employs war widows and women who otherwise have difficulty making their way in the world. If Frederick goes down, her shop goes down as well. And Amelia has had a really rough time of it herself. When she was 16, she was head over heels for a resident beefcake, Earl Sandhurst, but her father caught them in, let's say, a nearly compromising position before he became the Earl, and basically banished Pierce from ever going near Amelia again. She sent letters his way when she was able to, but no reply had ever come, so she had resigned to never seeing him again. Until tonight, when the sight of him had ripped Amelia's breath away. 12 years. Could it really have been that long since they'd last been together? But her heart knew it was so. The foolish thing had kept count. He changed over the years. The gangling 18-year-old she had known had become a man, leaving behind almost no trace of the boy that he'd once been. Yet she would have known him anywhere, despite the fine wrinkles that now crinkled in the corners of his blue eyes and the wide breadth of the muscular shoulders that army life and hard work had given him. Gone, too, was the restlessness she remembered, transformed now into a confidence that radiated from him like his rich scent of port and cigars, so heady and powerful, and just as masculine. When he'd approached her tonight, she felt as if time had folded in upon itself, and those years had never passed. The ache in her belly came so swiftly and fiercely at seeing him that for one excruciating moment she'd been transported back to Birmingham, when her world hadn't yet crumbled around her, when she still believed that she would always be with him.
Okay, so ignoring time folding like pancake batter, is the smell of cigars and booze supposed to be attractive? Like, do people actually like that smell on a person? Maybe it's the bad boy complex? I don't know. But judging by Amelia's past, you'd think that she would want to avoid bad boys. See, she had eloped 7 years ago with this bloke named Aaron Northam, and she had decided that Pierce wasn't coming back for her. So she thought she was in love with Aaron. And Aaron basically robbed her of her entire fortune left for her by her father, save for a single parcel of land. After careful calculations, no other soul knows that she was married other than her brother and herself. So Amelia is stuck in a rather sticky situation. Frederick's potential blackmailer threatens what little she's been able to recover of her life, because it's not just her future on the line anymore, but also the future of the women she's trying to help. In an effort to get ahead of the mess, she's trying to figure out exactly what's going on with Frederick, which is how she ended up borrowing a dress from a brothel madam and going undercover at a salacious party. Like you do. Amelia tries her best to be nonchalant when Frederick demands to see her the next morning, and we get more sticky situation. Frederick is an MP in the House of Lords of Parliament or something. I don't fully understand the British political system. The American one is enough of a headache, thank you. He has been trying to develop a turnpike trust. The trust, while gaining a fair amount of profit, will also have to run right through Amelia's property, which she has plans for with her charity. To make matters worse, Frederick admits to her that, yes, he is being blackmailed, so that he can push political appointments through, and somehow the Turnpike Trust is his way to do it. Why is anyone's guess, but that's the basic pressure points that they're all under. Please don't ask me to explain it any further, because I honestly don't get it. The books also keep mentioning a person named Prinny, and I had to look that up. And boy, it threw me for a loop when the first result was a cartoon penguin. Prinny is apparently Prince George IV, so there you go. No word if he turns into a bear like the last novel suggested. Anyway, the long and short of it is Frederick treats Amelia like a child and is threatening to close down her charity shop if she doesn't agree to sign over Bradenhill to him for the turnpike. Lovely fellow. And he also drops the bomb that he was discussing with Pierce to agree to the trust. So, there's that now. I mean, Jesus, what is with all these women getting forced into crap by the men in their lives? There must be, somewhere, a story where our heroine isn't backed into a corner with no other options other than to throw herself at the nearest alpha male and, damn it, I'm gonna find it. Unfortunately, I'm still stuck here. Meanwhile, Pierce heads to the Armory home base to discuss strategy with the group. They get deep into politics, who's being appointed where, and by who, and how Spectre is involved. It seems that Frederick Howard has been getting deep into things by buying influence and seems to be tangled up all in the center. He has approached Pierce at the ball to discuss the turnpike, and Pierce decides to follow that trail. Not because it would get him in close proximity with Amelia, of course not. But how convenient for him that he can help protect her from whatever's happening. But before all that, he goes to an underground boxing ring to relieve stress, like the proper historical romantic hero that he is. Meanwhile, Amelia returns her borrowed dress to the brothel owner. Madame Noir? Okay, let's go with that. And tries to get a bit more digging in. There's nothing really forthcoming. It seems that Charles Varnham doesn't solicit the brothel. But, Pierce did. Madame teases with Amelia, insinuating that Pierce is a generous visitor, and Amelia is obviously bothered by this. And of course, it's right after she leaves the brothel that Pierce shows up. Her carriage is stopped, and in swings the Brigadier himself, grinning like the cat with the canary. He thinks he's so suave, too, calling her Lady Scarlet and everything. Oh, and he's paid the carriage driver not to stop when she demand he does. So he's trapped her into having a conversation with him. Yay, more trapping women into vehicles to talk to them. But they do slip into an easy conversation, though. They clearly were very close once upon a time, and I will say that this is a better way to approach a couple that are immediately attracted to one another, instead of because the author wills it. They have a past, which explains the attraction. It's like pressing reheat on the microwave instead of cooking something from scratch. Ding! Your romance is ready! But despite everything, Amelia is still not playing ball. Just because he's trying to put her at ease to trust him, she knows that he was working with Frederick, and that is currently not in her best interests, so she's going to keep him at arm's length. She can't shake him, though. Even as the carriage drops her off at home, he follows her inside with the pretense of talking to Frederick. He even pulls rank on the butler to do it, being an earl and all. Amelia knows that she's trapped with the turnpike business, and asks Pierce that, if he ever truly loved her, to delay the trust as best as he can. And his white knight brain kicks into overdrive and figures that she is in some sort of trouble and resolves to help her. Later on, Pierce takes an armory colleague, Merritt, who also happens to be a high-ranking barrister to Madame Noir's brothel. And let's take a moment to appreciate that the author made the character who is basically the party paladin and named him Merritt. Well done. Also, it's a bad form to take a cop to a brothel, Pierce. What were you thinking? Oh, I know. You were underhandedly threatening a brothel owner with legal consequences so she would cooperate with you. Nice. Real nice, pal. They tried to get more information on Frederick Howard and why he's being blackmailed, but he's like most men in politics, gaining influence through back-alley deals and bribery. If there's anything particularly damning, they haven't uncovered it yet. Back at Amelia's homestead, Frederick is becoming more and more frantic about the turnpike, so much that he's now asked Amelia while she is at her shop to charm Pierce into agreement, just because they had been friends once upon a time. Yeah, just go ahead and pimp out your sister to get what you want, Frederick. That's fine. Actually, that's probably in line with most political goings-on, so carry on, I guess. And for the cherry on top, Frederick pulls a real nice place you got here, Shay, as he leaves. Dude, are you threatening your sister? Are you serious right now? Oh, but don't worry, Amelia. Pierce's white knight senses started tingling and he's made an appearance. There's a lot of tension between the two. Not only is Pierce pressing her about the turnpike and why she's so against it, but also why she never tried to write him. Except, dear listener, we know that she did write to him. But in the chaos that is war in an era before satellite communication, he'd never gotten any of her letters. This news haunts Pierce, because he would have replied. But he still needs more information from her. Luckily, Pierce knows how to push all her buttons. And I do mean all of them. She turned to look at him over her shoulder, only to find him standing right behind her. Right behind her. His nearness tingled across her skin and raised goosebumps in its heated wake. Her gaze dropped to his mouth, which lingered so close to hers that the warmth of his breath tickled her lips. She could kiss him simply by lifting onto her tiptoes. There would be solace there, she knew, an easing of the pain that made her long to simply lean back and bring herself into his arms. That's all it would take, just a simple shift of her body, not even turning around. And if she did, she would be lost. And while he's pushing buttons, Pierce gets awfully close to the worst secret Amelia has. She can't get rid of Braydenhill, since it's all she has, and she no longer has any fortune thanks to her disaster of an elopement, but Pierce can never know. She tells him that she found herself in a spot of financial trouble, and all that she had left was her property, which she wants to keep for her charity, and leaves it at that. She'd been hurt very deeply by Aaron and her sham of a marriage, and she's reluctant to trust any man ever again. I mean, I'd swear off the entire institution if I myself were in her shoes. Pierce can sense this, though, and decides to give her some trust of his own to ease her concern. Except, he does it by telling her that Frederick had been working with Spectre, and now this poor girl is freaking out about her brother getting involved in criminal organizations. Well done, Pierce. At least she can confirm that Frederick is being blackmailed, so, Pierce gets that in return. Oh, and he also steals a kiss. It's a weird moment for kissing, isn't it? Oh yeah, your brother is being blackmailed by a criminal organization. Smooch! I really wonder about these people's priorities. Amelia becomes overwhelmed with all her past hurt, though. I mean, who wouldn't? And pushes Pierce away, telling them that they weren't children anymore, that time has moved on. But clearly they still have real chemistry, and Pierce is not willing to back down without a fight. Thankfully, his military training kicks in, and he decides to make a strategic retreat. And he retreats only to find out that the Turnpike Trust has already been submitted to legislative review and is expected to pass in 2 days. Things are getting desperate now, and our resident White Knight is not happy about it. That night, Frederick drags poor Amelia to a ball that night in an effort to put his plan of baiting Pierce with her into motion. And he's very bad at the whole thing, since she finds Pierce literally the moment Frederick leaves to find him. Before words are exchanged, though, we meet the Duchess of Hampton, Danielle, I'm assuming, Braddock. She was the heroine from the previous novel in the series, an inconvenient duke. She hitched up to Marcus Braddock, the duke in question. He is also the head guy in charge of the armory. So, spoilers, I guess? She's also joined by her cousin tonight, and they are more than willing to cast a protective net around Amelia. Which is nice. I mean, what honorable young woman wouldn't love a duchess singling them out at a party and casting the mental warning, "Don't mess with this one, she's mine." Actually, that sounds awesome. I'd read the hell out of that. But before you might worry that the attention's going to draw back to the Duke, Amelia has you covered. Amelia had heard about the man. His leadership had been rated second only to Wellington's in the fight against the French. And looking at him now, she had to agree that he certainly possessed an imposing air that would have brooked no resistance when giving orders. But standing next to Pierce, the man seemed a bit lacking. Of course, she might have been biased, but Pierce appeared so much more untamed and dangerous, so much more muscular and solid, so much more dashing because of it. Am I to understand that the hero of the first novel and a literal general in war is lacking? I can't imagine a worse thing to call a man. I feel like there would be better ways to describe Marcus in a way that didn't interfere with Pierce's claim to a heroine and without completely emasculating him. Thankfully, Danielle has no idea about Amelia's thoughts, because she and her cousin are gleefully teasing Amelia about matching her with Pierce. While they're dithering on, Amelia watches as Frederick approaches Pierce and asks to speak with him in private, and Amelia is feeling the pressure of the situation. Overwhelmed, she runs off to find a retiring room. Just her bad luck that said retiring room happened to be the one Frederick chose, so she has to hide. The perspective shifts to Pierce and Frederick, and Pierce is called out for not seeming excited about the Turnpike. He gives a flimsy excuse that while the trust would make him money, he doesn't really need any more of it. And besides, he knows that Amelia has different plans for her land. This prompts an absolutely hilarious muck-up by Fred when he scoffs at Amelia's dream of a trade school for those, and I quote, "worthless war widows." Because that's how you endear a veteran of war to your cause, by insulting casualties and people left behind by said war. And he continues to dig by saying, Oh, no, the widows aren't worthless. No, it was the war itself. Such a waste, am I right? Pierce starts hoping that he can have an excuse to punch the guy, and while I don't always condone violence, Frederick probably deserves at least one good knock around. Sadly, it'll have to wait. Frederick leaves, and Pierce tells Amelia that she can come out of hiding. She is, of course, positively freaking out that he promised to give Frederick an answer by noon tomorrow about the turnpike, but they begrudgingly agree to work together in opposition to the trust, with a few cavats. Pierce decides then that business is done, so it's time for pleasure. His words. Oh, but oh no. Amelia is now in the presence of a man she is not related to, unchaperoned, and two men are making their way towards the room in search of better booze. What else can they do but hide? They get stuck behind a screen and very, very close to one another. As the interlopers settle in for a few rounds, the humidity gets dialed up with our two lovebirds. No. This was nothing like before when she was a girl, and he'd sneaked into her bedroom for long talks into the night, for stolen kisses and embraces. His shoulders were broader than before, his arms more muscular and strong. She bit back a groan. Good Lord, his abdomen was just as hard as his chest. Before, he'd been on the cusp of manhood, still a bit lanky and too full of energy to control himself completely when he was with her. But this. His hands rubbed deliberately over her hips in a slow caress that burned through her like wildfire. This was pure control. I'll admit, I was not expecting the exhibition thrill when I started this book, but given the pressure of the time period, it makes a little sense. He also licks the inside of her ear, and all I can think of is, please don't. Thankfully, before they get too deep into things, the two men leave and they are free to entangle themselves. Good thing, too, because Amelia basically breaks down under the pressure of both her current and past trauma and flees the room. She looks for Frederick and tries to take hold of her own situation by telling him she won't go along with his trust, and that no matter what kind of illegal nonsense he's gotten into, she doesn't want to be party to it anymore. He looks ready to slap her. But thankfully, the Duchess shows up to defuse the situation, using the excuse to invite Amelia over for lunch, and literally throwing the, "You know who my husband is, right?" gambit. Usually that kind of thing doesn't look good on a person, but Frederick knows when to shut up. He's dealt with, and Amelia is allowed to go home in peace. Or not. She hears the sounds of gunshots while in her carriage, which seems to be running rather roughly. She wonders if it's a riot and if she might be in danger, but the White Knight won't have any of that. Pierce gets her out of the carriage safely, and they make a run for it while being pursued by an unsavory sort. Pierce gets a moment to show how masculine he is by fighting off some of the attackers, and they manage to escape them all by doing something called shooting the bridge, meaning London Bridge. This was an absolutely stupid activity in which daring idiots would boat underneath the bridge, which was basically a roaring whitewater death trap. They survive, of course, but now they've got to lay low for a bit, and I am certain the entire reason they shot the bridge was so Amelia would get absolutely soaking wet, and our hero would have no other choice other than to get her out of that dress before she catches her death of cold. Who could have foreseen that? Pierce is still trying to get Amelia to spill all the beans about what she knows, but I can't help but feel they've been over this conversation a lot already, so I'm not really into it. But that doesn't matter, because we all know what's about to go down. There's more tension about their past, of course, and it finally bubbles over into the required steamy love scene. And I gotta say, I'm really glad that a lot of the scenes we've been finding in these books are not just insert tab A into slot B love scenes. Our heroes take their time with the ladies, making sure that they are pleasured beyond what they might expect. I suppose I shouldn't be so surprised. These are written by women with women in mind, after all. But it's good to see guys willing to kneel for our gals, if you catch my meaning. And this is very elegantly written. I might have been making fun of our plot line so far, but the author knows how to write these intimate moments. Well, maybe. At the end of the crescendo, this paragraph gives me some pause. With one last thrust, he sank deep and held himself tightly against her. His body arched above her as he poured himself into her, his buttocks squeezing to give up every last drop of his essence to her. Selfishly, she drank him in, refusing to surrender any part of him now that he was finally hers. I try not to get too graphic with these reviews, but, yeah. I should start a list maybe to find the most ridiculous ways to describe the male orgasm. Oh, and by the way, what's the first thing you'd want to hear from your partner after you've just had the best sex of your life? That they're already married! Yep, Amelia cannot stand this secret anymore and spills the beans. She describes how she met Aaron, how, while out on a walk, a kid had stolen her purse, and Aaron just happened to be there to stop him and courted her after that. All right, show of hands. We all know that was a scam, right? Yeah, that's what I thought. So Frederick permitted Aaron to court Amelia, and right before she turned 21, Aaron convinced her to elope while Frederick was away on business, telling her that Frederick had signed the proper paperwork. The next day after the wedding, Aaron had run off with all of her money. Shocked. I'm just shocked, I tell you. And now poor Amelia is convinced that this will push Pierce out of her life forever. But the White Knight won't give up without a fight, so he assures her that he is not going anywhere. Even with all my joking, though, this is the most admirable thing Pierce could do. She trusted him with a life-destroying secret, and he promised to work with her through the tunnel. Good man, that. The next day, Amelia finds herself at a ladies' social, and after not being able to stand the dissection of Voltaire any longer, she retires to soothe her headache and weep over her heart. Aw. One of the women, Lady Agnes, delivers some whiskey spiked with tea and gives her the, "I'm older than you, so listen when I say to go after your true love" speech. And Amelia gets into her head to find her old marriage settlement, the one that Frederick had never signed. She's decided that the scandal would be worth enduring if she could have Pierce by her side and wants to push for an annulment. She races home to sort through her brother's papers, but comes across an interesting note. A note of payment from her brother to Aaron, dated around the same time they'd met. Okay, show of hands. We all know that Frederick paid Aaron to trick her, right? Yeah, that's what I thought. So of course Frederick is going to catch her going through his papers, so she deflects to tell him that she wanted to check her marriage settlement, just to make sure that Bradenhill was truly hers. That way she could confidently agree to the trust. Frederick is thrilled and takes the bait, and he can tell her that Pierce has also agreed. At first, Amelia's a little bit hurt, but she's learned enough about him now to know that something else is going on, so she's going to continue to trust him. But she's not willing to let him off the hook so easy, though, so she basically ambushes him at the armory. He tells her that things are getting really into the thick of it. Several lives, including hers, are now at risk, so he has to move fast. He's even meeting up with Frederick for one last reconnaissance mission tonight to get to the bottom of whatever this mess is. Oh, and they, smoosh again, so there's that. Is it just me, or is it weird that anybody can get into the mood when there's blackmail and murder to deal with? As for that meeting with Frederick, well, let me paint a picture for you. Imagine a high school edgelord. He dresses in all black and decorates himself and his notebooks with inverted religious imagery. Now imagine that he gets to build a sex club. That's what we get when Frederick drags Pierce off to a club meeting. Pierce finds himself in some old Roman ruins, surrounded by nuns who are nothing of the sort, and men who think they are just so cool for being in a super secret club with totally not lame rituals, you guys. They call it a hellfire club because of course they do. And the guy leading the entire thing is Arthur Varnum, brother to Charles Varnum, the fellow that Amelia had been trying to get information from concerning her brother's blackmail. It's a case of barking up the wrong tree, and now that we can all agree that Frederick Howard is a screaming idiot. We shift back to Amelia as she watches her brother stumble up the house steps after his club meeting, and she's ready to tell him that she wants to pursue an annulment, but oh no, men from Bow Street have shown up to arrest Frederick. Who could have foreseen this? Amelia takes no time to alert her maid to send a message to Pierce before going out to help Frederick, but that's when another carriage shows up, carrying none other than Arthur Varnum. Egads! He was hoping to stop his brother Charles from arresting Frederick, you know, because reasons. He would be ever so willing to drop Miss Amelia off at Westminster if she joined him and his female cousin in their carriage. I mention the female cousin bit because an unmarried woman really shouldn't be seen alone ever with a man, and Arthur used it to his full advantage to trick Amelia into his carriage. The cousin leaves the carriage, and Arthur uses Amelia's married name, and that's when her oh crap meter starts screaming. And as a proper villain, Arthur can't help but reveal his whole blackmail scheme, and that's how Amelia finds out that her marriage was arranged by Frederick so he could steal her money. Wow, sure didn't see that coming. But now that Frederick was arrested, something Arthur was genuinely trying to stop, he's useless to help with Spectre's schemes. But now there's another man in the trust that Arthur now has leverage over. That's right, Brandon Pierce, Earl of Sandhurst, will have no choice but to push the trust through to get Spectre's plans in motion, if he doesn't want harm to come to Amelia. So now it's a rescue mission, and Pierce takes the other lords of the armory to infiltrate the club, where they eventually find Amelia stuck in a stone sarcophagus, because Arthur is theatrical as all get out. Pierce gets her out while the others interrogate Arthur about Spectre. Shock of shocks, Spectre wants to ignite a revolution that usurps the monarchy, like you do. They get what they want out of him, then chuck him in the general direction of Australia, like you do. And before we forget sweet Frederick, he is sprung from jail, gets slapped in the face by our dear Amelia, and sent packing towards America. All's well that ends well, right? Almost. Pity about that sham marriage, but since she signed her name in the parish registry and everything, except, oh wait, at an engagement but who knows when they can get married party, Merritt had tracked down the paper with her name on it and left a carefully forged duplicate in its place. So now there was no real record of her marriage, and thanks to Frederick's self-exile, she has control of her money once again. Now she and Pierce are allowed to live happily ever after. I guess. It's a little hard to sum up my feelings on this one, really. I liked parts of it, other bits I could have done without. It's very much a hodgepodge of a novel. Probably the thing that stands out the most is that, other than the setting, I didn't really get the impression that it was a historical novel. When we compare this to A Wolf in Duke's Clothing, the language is completely different. With our wolf boy, the vernacular is steeped in Regency dialogue and narration, while An Unexpected Earl used very modern language. That's not to say that they used 21st century slang, and I'm not asking for Shakespearean cadence, but it felt a little lacking and left me with a rather shallow impression. And poor Amelia! Again, we see ourselves with a heroine with no agency. She was controlled her entire life by men who treated her like an object to be manipulated and got tossed around only because she had no leverage of her own. Yeah, she had a goal to work towards, helping the war widows, but instead of it being something she could strive for, it was held above her as a threat. And the moment she decided to do something about her awful situation, she gets kidnapped for her troubles. I'm also on the fence as to whether or not I should go back and read the first book, if only to orient myself into the world that I just visited. It's a little like taking a tour of a campus before you start working there full time. You have no reference for anything that you see, and it's only after you've been there a while where things click into place. But for all my qualms, it's well written. The characters have clear motivations, and the plot was compelling, despite my disdain for British politics. I would say that it was like watching a more recent Disney film, like, say, Rapunzel or Frozen. The backdrop of Regency England is only that, a backdrop, but the story and its characters are very modern. So on that note, let's go ahead with the final score. And we'll start with that cover. I'll go ahead and be generous and give a 3 out of 5. I know what I said about the couple and the way that they were dressed, but it honestly fits with my perception of the book. They look like they got lost in a bag of historical costumes and decided to put on a show for all of us. I'd say it works. Drama is going to get a grand 5 out of 5. It had everything. A sham marriage, a seditious secret society, blackmail, kidnapping, the works. It was absolutely ridiculous, and if I am being completely honest in my most secret of hearts, I am here for it. Romance will get a 4 out of 5. I like this take on the couple having feelings for one another right off the bat. It drives me up the wall if they are automatically attracted to one another, and the book doesn't explore why that might be. But childhood sweethearts separated by angry fathers and a literal war? It's a perfect setup. We get tension from Amelia's fears of abandonment, and rightfully so, along with Pierce's guilt from not being able to pursue her sooner. But Pierce's white knighting got on my nerves, as you could probably tell. Now, as for realism, that's going to get a 2 out of 5. The concept of the novel is rather ridiculous. So, there's a bunch of war veterans who decided to start up a club to track down secret evil societies without, I'm assuming, the blessing of the authorities? Yeah, sure. The leader of the group is a freaking duke, but I really doubt that the powers that be will be chill with it. Heck, it might even be a plot point in a future novel. And then there's the matter that I didn't feel entirely like I was in a Regency environment. You could dress up all of these characters in different clothes from different eras and change literally nothing else and you'd get the same story. The only hiccup would come with Amelia's need to be chaperoned, but that didn't really impact the story much. You can kidnap women without the pretense. So, yeah, my thoughts on An Unexpected Earl are all over the place. It was not an unenjoyable read, though. I'll admit to having fun with all of the nonsense, because if not, then what is nonsense even good for? I'd say it was a fun little romp with reconnected love, and I'd say go ahead and check it out, but maybe read An Inconvenient Duke first. For my final score, An Unexpected Earl gets 3 secret societies out of 5. Thank you so much for joining me today, dear listeners, and I hope to see you again next time for Heather Reads, the podcast. If you like the show, you can visit us at heatherreads.com. If you have any questions or you just want to say hi, you can email us at podcast@heatherreads.com. Music today is by Kilofon from Pixabay. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster, and our technical advisor is Kwang Hin Cho. And remember, it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.